Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Williams will be joining us by teleconference. She has a situation which causes her to be in Detroit today. So, Judge Williams, are you there?
I am, Judge Caney.
Thank you.
Morning.
The first case this morning is Michael Sutherland versus... those are the counsel. First case is the estate of Rudy Escobedo versus Martin.
Judge Caney, members of the court. First, let me say this is a very complex case procedurally. Initially, as this court knows, the defendants took an appeal challenging a ruling granting qualified immunity to several defendants. This court affirmed the trial court on that matter and remanded. The plaintiffs were under the impression that they still had alive a wrongful death claim or a claim under the Fourth Amendment for excessive force. However, a succession of rulings by the trial court eliminated that claim and eviscerated the right of Rudy Escobedo, that is his estate, to pursue this claim before a jury. The decision by the incident commander Bender to discontinue negotiations and initiate the tactical solution, and those are his terms, violated Rudy Escobedo's rights under the Fourth Amendment. There were no exigent circumstances to justify that use of deadly force and the initiation of the assault with tear gas projectiles exploding in his apartment, in his room. The summary judgment ruling early on and the trial court's subsequent rulings eviscerated the plaintiff's claim of pursuing a wrongful death claim under the Fourth Amendment. That is, they should have been able to foresee that the initiation of the tactical solution, firing the projectiles, sending in the takedown team, the SWAT team, with flashbangs and machine guns, would result in a situation greatly enhancing the chance that Rudy Escobedo would be harmed or killed. Every witness that testified, both for the defendant's expert, the plaintiff's expert, said that once the tactical solution is initiated, it increases the harm immensely for Rudy, for the police officers, and for the public. The jury was not allowed.
Your challenge, that was pretty much what was confined to that decision. Is that right?
I'm having trouble hearing you, Judge.
I'm not sure what's going on here. The decision, what we call the tactical solution, that was the main challenge about. Isn't that coming? Has funneled down to.
That's the main theory, Your Honor. There were some other evidentiary rulings which further limited the plaintiff's opportunity to present a case, and under Sherrod, we think, influenced the jury or biased the jury to consider matters that they should have been prohibited to consider. And that's because evidence was introduced which the decision-makers, the commanders, did not have at the time they made this decision. Now, what is very important here is that the judge, and we believe the defendants, the judge through her rulings and the defendants through their argument confounded the decisions that were made by creating a false equivalency, namely conflating Rudy's mental health situation, his mental health crisis, with an act of criminality. There was no act of criminality. There was no threat to the public. There was no threat to the police. And under a series of cases which we cite in our brief, such as Sled, Yates, and Rush, Rush versus the City of Mansfield, which is a Northern District case decided in 2011, Northern District of Ohio, the SWAT team entered a home without effectively knocking on the door and announcing themselves, and they killed an armed resident. Now, the facts may be a little dissimilar to our situation, but what the court held and cited what they called a universal simple rule: when a constitutional violation occurs, liability attaches for the harm that is a direct proximate result of the constitutional violation. Applying the principle to the Rush case, if the defendants fail to knock and announce their presence as required by the Fourth Amendment or otherwise commit a constitutional violation, and if that failure was a proximate cause of Mr. Rush's death, then the plaintiffs may recover damages under 1983. The principle in that case, and many others we cite, is a bedrock principle of constitutional law under the Fourth Amendment, namely, that when an officer commits a Fourth Amendment violation, in this case, making the decision arbitrarily, establishing a deadline to initiate the tactical assault, the use of projectiles that exploded in his home, and the use of the SWAT team or takedown team forcing entry into his apartment and confronting him in his bedroom. All of that was entirely foreseeable, and the foreseeability of that conduct was demonstrated by each and every witness that said that the heightened risk to the officers, to Rudy, and the public was created by the exigent circumstances of these officers making the decision and going into his apartment.
And then just so I can be clear, I mean, your theory is that, bottom line, the commanding officer's decision to initiate a specific tactical response was the proximate cause of his death, and because the death was foreseeable, that use of force was excessive. And your bottom line is you were not permitted to make that argument to the jury, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is exactly the case, is that if this case were allowed to stand, if this holding by the trial judge were allowed to stand, it would undo an enormous body of law, which really establishes that this principle, which was decided in a very recent case of Phillips versus Community Insurance Corporation, decided this year by this court. A desire to resolve quickly a potential dangerous situation is not the type of government interest that standing alone justifies the use of force that may cause serious injury in effecting an arrest. That's a very simple principle that we have in this case. And the case goes on to say much more. The objective reasonableness of force is a legal determination rather than a pure question of fact for the jury. We defer to the jury's determination, which is in this situation, that's the Escobedo situation, of what occurred during an arrest or the circumstances leading up to the arrest. But a constitutional tort is not an analog of civil liability. In an excessive force case, we accept the factual inferences made by the jury, but we must independently review the interpretation of what is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And that's what we are asking this court to do. What the trial court did was, first of all, procedurally, leave ambiguous whether or not we had a wrongful death claim or, more properly, an excessive force claim which led to the death. We asked for clarification early on. We didn't get it. We asked for clarification, both of us did, early on, and we didn't get it. Then we got a ruling close to the trial in which she said you are not going to be allowed to come in the back door with your proximate cause theory. Proximate cause is a theory of liability, contrary to what the defendants have asserted in their briefs. It is not a theory of damages. So what we were left with was the demeaning and humiliating pursuit of damages, a component of damages that would allow Rudy to recover for the effect of tear gas and flashbang that were utilized during his assault.
Now, getting back to this, because you mentioned earlier this whole state of mind question, and in your view, it wasn't relevant, and that testimony should have been excluded, but wasn't the door open to his state of mind by you asking the sister about his demeanor? Why isn't the evidence of his potential prison term and psychological history admissible? I think you and speak to that as it relates to liability and damage.
Yes, that's a good question, Judge. We did ask the family, because that's the only way we could establish who Rudy was as a person. We had to ask the family about his background and his experience. And they testified that they had, in fact, enjoyed a 4th of July celebration just a few days before he was shot and killed on July the 19th. The defendant's position was that they should be able to look at the psychological evaluation of 1999 of Rudy, taken by Dr. Cates, and we argued that it was irrelevant and immaterial. The court found that it could be used for both terms of liability and damages.
And there was a six-year gap between when that evaluation was done and this incident took place, correct?
That is correct. And we argued under Sherrod that this was not information which the commanders had or the shooters had. This was not information that was available to anybody until they questioned Dr. Cates on the witness stand.
But there was something, I mean, the whole charge and the potential a guilty plea, which was to occur 2 days after. Now, that was more a more timely incident in terms of the 2 weeks, because the sister testified about the 4th of July, which was about 2 weeks, I think, before this incident took place. So I think the argument is that, you know, he was facing this 5 years in prison, and that would have some bearing on his state of mind and also some bearing on damages, as I understand it. You've dealt with the psychological report. Speak to that other issue.
I'd be glad to, Your Honor. It's another good point. The defendants wanted that information to come in to demonstrate that Rudy was never coming out. In fact, I could almost quote it. He's never coming out. No matter what they say, no matter how long we wait, he is never coming out. That was a conclusion that is not justified in any of the evidence. It was speculative. We felt like if you applied Rule 403 and you applied Sherrod, it shouldn't have come in at all. But it did come in and gave the defendants a powerful argument, which they utilized at the end of the case in their closing argument, namely that Rudy was a bad person, that he chose a lifestyle in using substance drugs and alcohol, and that he got what he deserved. They transformed Rudy's plea for help into a criminal assault, an attack on a criminal person. There was no crime involved. When we deposed Chief Bender, one of the early deponents, we asked him, why were you there? He said, well, we were there to help Rudy. Was there any crime committed? No, there was not. Now, they changed their story later and said, well, he had a gun. That was a crime. But here's the point, is all of this information went to the jury, and none of the information that we wanted the jury to consider was allowed to go to the jury and be considered. Instruction number 24 specifically prohibited the jury from considering the death of Escobedo, of Rudy Escobedo, and making any determination about the outcome of this case.
Now, your concern, one of them at least, is that the police didn't know these facts.
They did not know those facts.
And making the decision to go in, they weren't aware of the fact that he was anticipating a very short time going into face a sentencing, plea or guilty or sentencing. I guess you're saying they didn't know that. Now, he said he was on cocaine on
the
phone.
So
they knew that.
Cocaine.
So they knew he was high on cocaine. They knew he had a gun.
Well,
he said he had a gun.
He said he had a gun. They should rely upon that. I agree.
So the question is what they would anticipate. Now, as you know, the judge said things were a lot different at the trial as opposed to what she knew at summary judgment. And that's why I went through all this very detailed testimony. Well, that's what she said.
She did say that. We disagree emphatically. If you look at the record that was presented to this court on summary judgment, there was no new evidence. It's all speculative. They wanted to punish Rudy Escobedo for being on the seventh floor because it gave him a tactical advantage, as if, you know, he had to choose to be on the ground to commit suicide. They wanted to convert the fact that he had a gun. Later on, it became a gun that could shoot a mile. They didn't know that. In fact, the guns that the police officers had were much more dangerous to the public. They had high-powered machine guns. They had flashbangs. They were more dangerous to the public than Rudy was. The point, Judge, is that Rudy did nothing. If you remember, he called his sister. He wanted to talk to his sister. He had promised to meet his sister at the hospital that he chose. He wanted to meet his counselor. He wanted to come out in 3 minutes. He changed his mind, but he vacillated, something that is very common. Nobody in this courtroom would believe that calling 911 for help, if you had a family member present, would lead to a SWAT team entering the house 2 hours after negotiations begin with a formal person.
Getting back to this, what the police knew with respect to what was upcoming, in terms of the charges, I believe I read that somebody ran, they ran a criminal history check on him, and so they knew that this hearing was coming up. They knew that.
I don't believe
at the time,
they did.
Right?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor. What they learned from checking the Spellman case, the Spellman record, which is an electronic database, according to Officer Zelt, Lieutenant Zelt was a tactical commander. He claimed to have viewed that and claims to have reviewed Rudy's criminal history, none of which included felonies, which included certainly a history of substance abuse.
So it's just substance abuse arrest and convictions and this recent arrest for drunk driving. It didn't show any resolution of that.
It did not, nor did it indicate the upcoming trial date.
Okay. And it was the trial date for, was it related to this drunk driving charge?
It was related to the last previous charge.
The last previous charge, okay.
As so, I understand it, Judge. And so, in this case, they wanted, I suspect, for that to come in to justify their position that they're wasting their time. Now, no matter how long they spend here, it's going to be resolved in a very negative way. And that's simply not the case. Nationally or on average, it's just not the case. There was a very similar case, if I might express this situation, which happened this year in Indianapolis. A police officer was falling out with his fiancée. He was fully armed. He stood on a knoll in a very small private park on the north side of Indianapolis between Meridian Street and Illinois Street. They blocked traffic for 3.5 hours. They had a church nearby. Sound familiar? They had a school they locked down. Sound familiar? And they didn't do anything except talk to him. They brought the family members to the scene. They didn't use tear gas. They brought a minister to the scene. And after 4 hours of blocking traffic on Meridian Street between 8:30 and 1 o'clock, they resolved the situation. The city councilman, said he really applauded the patience of the police department. And so we think that the holding in Phillips, and we think the holding in the cases we cite regarding proximate cause and the circumstances leading up to the use of deadly force, demonstrate that expediency is not an excuse unless there's an exigent situation, unless there's actual evidence that the person is in fact about to harm the public. There are many other issues which we've raised in our brief. I'll have to defer to those. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Keene.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In February of 2011, we had an 8-day jury trial of this case. There were more than a dozen witnesses that testified, including experts for both sides. At the end of that 8-day jury trial, a 12-person jury rendered a verdict in favor of all the defendants, finding no constitutional violation had occurred whatsoever. Judge Spreeman then took the very unusual step of keeping under advisement our Rule 50 motion on qualified immunity. And after reviewing the transcript of the entire trial, she issued a lengthy opinion granting that motion, finding that not only was the jury correct in its decision, but in fact the defendants were all entitled to qualified immunity with regard to all of the claims which had been advanced in the case. I've tried a lot of cases. I've made a lot of Rule 50 motions. I've won a lot of cases on defense verdicts, and I've never had a judge do that. Never had a judge go over the top of a jury and, in addition to that, find that the motion should be granted as well. The same judge that denied our motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity. She went in very detailed fashion and described why the facts were different at trial than they had been on summary judgment, and they were in significant part, and why she felt strongly that qualified immunity did apply to this case.
Well, as a result of the, you know, we heard the summary judgment appeal the first time, and I know, me included, said, what the heck? Why did they go through all of this when they could have just stayed on the phone and not bothered everybody? This is what it looked like. And then when Judge Spreeman had the trial, this is what caused her to find many more details and many things to at least authenticate or justify what the decision they made for that tactical solution. Now, that seems to be the state's expert, the only issue that he really disagreed with with your expert was the decision, the technical solution.
That's right. And that was very different testimony than had been on summary judgment because, of course, I couldn't cross-examine the expert and have his testimony presented the way it was at trial. And that's why we have trials.
Judge Mannion said, we found that it was unreasonable to throw a flashbang device blindly into an apartment except very limited circumstances. And in terms of the district court's finding after the qualified immunity determination, I have some issue with the way she weighed the testimony, and then there was certain evidence that was not considered. She found that he was unusually dangerous. I have some issues with that. He was essentially a danger to himself, so I'm trying to grapple with facts that she says support that conclusion.
Well, one of the most important facts was their own expert conceded it would have been improper and in violation of national standards for them not to use a flashbang to go into that heavily barricaded bedroom when they knew he was high on cocaine, delusional, and had a gun that he would never put down. That would have been contrary to national standards of SWAT team activity. Now, the reason that he had to throw it in the way he did is because of the way the bedroom was so heavily barricaded. We had photographs introduced at the trial that showed they literally had to break the door in half with a barricade to get any entry to the room at all. The bed spring and the frame and dressers were pushed up against that way. There was simply no way that Officer Straub could have deployed that flashbang other than to throw it over the top of that barricade. If he deployed it on the other side of the barricade, it would have only affected the officers and given them no cover to go through that door. These officers had to assume, no matter what Rudy Escobedo had indicated previously, that he might fire at them with that gun. It would have been unsafe for them to do so otherwise. Yet they still made this argument to the jury, the same argument that it was excessive force and unreasonable to do this, and the jury rejected it. This court is not in a position to re-examine the evidence and reach a separate independent determination of whether the decision of the jury was a correct one. This court is required to give substantial deference to the jury decision. That's why we have jury trials. They're the people, along with the judge, that heard all of the evidence and can judge the credibility and the demeanor of the witnesses. They're only entitled to a new trial if they can show that any error that occurred denied them a fair trial.
Well, if we decide that the district court erred when it granted summary judgment in favor of the officers who shot Escobedo, how does that affect Escobedo's proximate cause argument?
It doesn't for an important reason. They made exactly the same argument as to why the officers used excessive force when they made the decision to go in, and it's the same decision they're disputing with regard to the shooting, the decision to stop talking and go into a tactical mode. That's the same decision, the same issue of excessive force. They made the same argument before the jury that the use of flashbangs and the tear gas constituted excessive force. They made those same arguments. The jury knew that Rudy Escobedo had been shot and killed as a result of this. They knew that. And yet the jury rejected those arguments and found that there was no excessive force with regard to all of those decisions and all of the tactics that were used. So if the jury rejected that and found that that was not excessive force, then the fact that they didn't go on and find that the shooting didn't constitute excessive force is irrelevant. It's moot. They already decided there was no constitutional violation in the first place.
What purpose did the evidence of his plea hearing and possible pre-sentence and prison sentence serve? You know, I think your position is that it was relevant to Escobedo's conduct, but what was the real dispute over his conduct?
Well, certainly there was a dispute about why he wasn't coming out and whether he could or would. And Mr. Sutherland in his argument said that it was speculative on the part of the defendants to argue that because of his impending 5-year prison sentence that he wasn't going to come out. It was speculative on their part from the very beginning of the case to argue if there had been more time and the cocaine would have diminished in his system that he would have come out. And that was their whole theme of the case. Their whole theme of the case that he was temporarily suicidal because he was high on cocaine. And if the officers had simply waited a little longer, he would have come to his senses and come out. This evidence showed that there was another reason why he wasn't coming out, why he was conducting himself in that fashion. Plus, as you indicated, they did open the door with respect to this issue. They had their own witnesses testify about the pending charges of DUI that he was facing. Their own witnesses who said he told his sister that he had an upcoming court hearing that he was worried about. They also put in the testimony of the sister about the phone call that very night, where he told the sister that he had done something stupid and was going away for a long time. They put all of that evidence in.
But what about this 1999 psychological assessment, which was like 6 years old, I mean, at the time this incident occurred? What possible relevance did that have? And that untimely?
And with regard to the testimony of Dr. Cates, who they called as their witness, to put in evidence with regard to Rudy Escobedo's psychological history, they're the ones that called him and asked him questions about his treatment of Rudy Escobedo, about the relationship they had and how long-standing it was, about the fact of what kind of treatment he'd received for what problems. When they opened the door to that evidence, we had every right to ask about all of that treatment and what it related to and what his findings were with regard to Rudy Escobedo, and more importantly, why he told Lieutenant Hunter that he wouldn't be of any help to come down there and assist with negotiations if Rudy Escobedo was on drugs, because you couldn't reason with him in that condition. So it went on to explain why Dr. Cates did not come to the scene and why it didn't make sense for Lieutenant Hunter to push him to do so. More importantly, though, there's been no showing whatsoever that that psychological assessment played any part in the jury's decision to find that there was no excessive force used. Also, it would go to the issue of damages with regard to his mental state at the time and what damages he'd be entitled to if the jury found in his favor. But in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about two isolated pieces of evidence in an 8-day jury trial. 8 days of testimony and lots of exhibits, two minor pieces of evidence.
As I understand it, and I'll use this as a distinction, what was their expert's name?
Danaher.
Yeah, Danaher, and what was the other, McCarthy?
Yes.
Yeah, the real difference seemed to be with Danaher was he said the decision, the tactical solution, should not have been made, that instead they should have continued to negotiate till hell freezes over, basically.
That's exactly what he said.
And so then, that's other than that, though, once that decision was made, then I guess you were cross-examining him.
I was.
You looked through very thoroughly that every other decision, including the flashbang and other things, you probably recall I had a little problem with that on the summary judgment,
right,
about what could be done and what they should have done. But he agreed that all the things that they did after that under those circumstances, the conditions that they created, admittedly, the place is full of tear gas, it's dark, it's got all sorts of problems. These guys, the cops have gas masks on, and, you know, the vision is not good. That all came in at the trial. And so there's only that one element of disagreement.
That's exactly right. That was the only thing that he said that he disagreed with. And even then, when I pressed him about how long they should negotiate under their circumstances, he would not give any time. He basically said until it was resolved peacefully, no matter how long it took. Well, isn't that something that clearly cries out to say, well, that has to be subject to qualified immunity? If it's that much discretion, if there's no standard where you could say you must negotiate for 6 hours, you must negotiate for 12 hours, you must negotiate for 20 days, if there's no standard, then how do the police decide what to do other than exercise reasonable judgment under the circumstances? And if they make a mistake, aren't they entitled to qualified immunity for that? Isn't that what qualified immunity is for? Aren't they entitled to qualified immunity unless the plaintiff can show that every reasonable police officer in that circumstance would have acted differently? That's what qualified immunity is for. That's why Judge Springman found they were entitled to qualified immunity. She denied it on summary judgment because those facts weren't there. I didn't have Danaher agreeing with me on cross-examination to all those things. I did at the trial. She clearly was influenced by that testimony, along with other testimony of the commanders explaining the public safety reasons about why they acted as they did, explaining the concerns about him being delusional on cocaine and having this gun on the seventh floor of a building that was surrounded by a hospital, a newspaper, a church with a daycare center.
Well, I guess what say someone could disagree with that decision and maybe do it differently, but as far as qualified immunity under these circumstances, that it wasn't well, that they had qualified immunity because it wasn't clearly established that you couldn't do that.
That's exactly right. That's what it says in all the case law, that qualified immunity allows for reasonable mistakes. Reasonable mistakes in judgment and action.
As a lay person, just the example he gave down in Indianapolis, well, they waited 4 hours and held up traffic all 4 hours. It's obviously a great big mess for the sake of one guy to try to prevent him from shooting himself. And, okay, that's certainly one option, but there's no clearly established way. That's the only way you can do it.
That's exactly right.
Even though I can sit here as a layperson and say there had to be a better way than this.
And obviously, in hindsight, which you're not allowed to do, with the result that happened, would they have done it differently? Of course they may have done it differently if they knew that's what would happen. But they knew from their experience, and these were very experienced commanders that had gone through this situation many, many times before, that when negotiations weren't progressing after a reasonable period of time and they used tear gas, almost every time the person came out, the situation was resolved peacefully and no one got hurt. What would be the family's argument if the officers had did nothing and just sat there and did nothing and waited hours and days and longer periods of time, and then he just shot and killed himself? What would the family complain about then? They would say, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you go in there and try and get him out? He obviously wasn't responding to your negotiations. You should have done something. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's why these officers have to be protected by qualified immunity, because no two situations are the same. Because every time there's a different suspect, so no two situations are the same, and they have to exercise reasonable judgment based upon what they know, the circumstances, what their past experiences have told them, what's worked in the past, and that's what they did here.
Well, there was his position on the seventh floor, having the high ground, had a gun that supposedly had a range of a mile. There's a hospital two blocks away and a kindergarten nearby. And having high ground is sort of, military,
That's right.
That's where you want to be. It wasn't when I was in Vietnam, that wasn't where I wanted to be anyway, but I would say that. But it is, that's what they were reflecting on.
Absolutely.
Now, that came before the jury, and I guess that's what we're stuck with. I don't say that was speculative or wrong, but that's what the reason was that they at least were using to say, that's where he is. You can't just, it's not an isolated place where you can surround him and let him alone.
That's right. And to suggest you could just leave that situation in this static situation for hours or days and just keep it the way it is, that's unrealistic.
Well,
obviously,
when you look at the qualified immunity finding the court made, various hypothetical scenarios were discussed, and there was not as much focus on the use of the tear gas that was motivated by a desire to end the negotiation rather than him being a threat to public safety. I mean, am I understanding your argument? You're saying he was a threat to the officers? Because in terms of public safety, I mean, I understand once the officers got in there and he still had a gun, I understand what went down. But in terms of threats to public safety, the magistrate Judge Springman, didn't spend a lot of time on that in the finding.
You're right, but there was evidence with respect to that. Both all of the commanders testified about their concerns that this gun could be fired out the window, that he wouldn't even have to be at the window to fire this gun, and it was a semi-automatic handgun, and it could be fired with a range up to a mile. There's no way that the police could keep pedestrians outside of that range of a mile from his seventh floor window. There's nothing they could do to stop it. And there was testimony that someone who's high on cocaine like he was is very unpredictable, erratic. He was delusional. You have to remember there was evidence that he said he saw police officers outside the windows of his apartment. Obviously, they weren't there, but he saw them and feared they were coming through the windows to get him. So there was certainly a lot of evidence that suggested that there was a real potential threat to the public as he continued to be on chi and cocaine, delusional, and would not put this weapon down. So Judge Springman did find that there were public safety concerns, along with the other reasons given that the negotiations were not progressing and that a tactical response was warranted, or at least that the officers exercised reasonable judgment in so concluding. And again, to avoid qualified immunity, the plaintiff must demonstrate no reasonable police officer would have so concluded. They didn't do that. They didn't come close to doing that. They made the very same arguments they're making today in front of that jury of 12 people, and they rejected those arguments. Rejected them. So they're not, they cannot come here and make the same arguments and try and convince you that you should accept them and place your opinion and decision in the place of that jury. That's why we have jury trials. They had a fair opportunity to present their case. All of the arguments you've heard today, they made then. The jury had to decide whether the decision to go from negotiations to tactics was reasonable. Did it violate the Fourth Amendment? The jury said no, it did not.
Now, the main evidence of that was from, what is it, the commanding officer or whatever? Who testified
Bender.
About? I don't remember the names.
Bender was the commander-in-chief, and Zelt was the tactical commander, and Hunter was the negotiations commander.
Well, who testified about the decision to go in and how they were going through that?
Well, Bender testified about the reasons the decision was made and why he decided to go from negotiations to tactical response. Lieutenant Zelt explained why the tactical plan was done in the way he set it up. With regard to the summary judgment ruling that preceded the trial, where Judge Springman found that there was no right to pursue a wrongful death claim, at that summary judgment ruling, the only evidence that she had to consider was the testimony of the two officers that shot Rudy Escobedo. They both testified unequivocally that he pointed the gun directly at them just a few feet from them after they were yelling at him to put it down, that he pointed it at them and they fired. He dropped the gun, then they stopped firing. He bent over, tried to pick the gun up again, and so they shot him and killed him at that point. That was the only evidence presented on summary judgment. The plaintiffs didn't present any contrary evidence or argument that that didn't happen until the court granted the summary judgment motion. Then in a motion to reconsider, they raised evidence regarding forensic testimony of the pathologist. They tried to raise evidence regarding credibility issues of the two officers based on reports and other things and statements they had made. But Judge Springman correctly concluded that you can't raise those kind of evidentiary arguments on motions to reconsider once you've already lost summary judgment when you had the full opportunity to do so in response to the summary judgment motion. They conceded that they didn't present that evidence in response to summary judgment for a tactical reason. They wanted to save it for impeachment at trial. They wrongly guessed that Judge Springman wouldn't grant that motion for summary judgment and withheld the evidence. So they waived it. They waived that argument by not presenting the evidence. That was a poor choice on their part, but they made it. And so they can't now complain that Judge Springman shouldn't have granted that motion for summary judgment when the only evidence was that Rudy Escobedo pointed that gun at these officers when they were yelling at him to put it down.
What other evidence could there have been other than the police?
Well, they presented on the motion to reconsider the pathologist's evidence about where the bullets entered through his hand and his arm. That's and whether that was consistent with him pointing the gun at them. Now, the pathologist said it was. They tried to make an argument about why it wasn't based upon that. They also had reports from the officers and statements the officers given to internal affairs, and they tried to argue that there were inconsistencies between what those statements said and what their deposition testimony said to suggest that there were some credibility issues that they might not or they should not be believed in what they said. They should have made those arguments in response to the summary judgment motion. They didn't. They chose not to deliberately. So Judge Springman, under those circumstances, she had no choice but to grant summary judgment based upon the only testimony and evidence that she had to consider, which clearly justified the shooting. Now, again, by the time this case got to trial, even though they weren't allowed to make an argument that they were entitled to damages for the shooting, they made the same arguments in support of their other theories of excessive force, and the jury rejected it. We ask that the court affirm what the district court did in all respects and the jury verdict return in the favor of the defendants.
Thank you, counsel. How much time does...
3 minutes.
Three,
thank you. Jury instruction number 24. The court previously dismissed the wrongful death claim asserted by the plaintiff estate regarding the shooting of Rudy Escobedo. All claims against the members of the entry team, officers Martin, Brown, Straub, and Lieutenant Sylvia. You are not to speculate on the reasons for the court's decisions. The jury never got to hear any of that. Never got to hear any of that. Secondly,
did you ever hear any of what?
Of the evidence that related to Rudy Escobedo's death.
The actual shooting?
The actual shooting. And to answer your question, Judge Mannion, there were a number of things. He misstated the evidence. The forensic pathologist said that the bullet entering the outside of the left hand, which supposedly held his gun here, coming out the palm and striking the fleshy part of the upper arm, was inconsistent with somebody extending their gun hand straight out. But what he did say was, we can't say whether that bullet striking the hand was the first shot fired in response to the police officers coming and seeing him having a gun in his hand or later. But it didn't strike the gun. The gun had no mark on it. Secondly, there were no latent fingerprints on it. And so when you looked at the testimony of the officers in depositions and also in their internal affairs, one officer, the shooter, says the hand was 6 to 8 inches from his chest when he shot. That's consistent with the trajectory going in the flat back of his hand, coming out the palm, and hitting here. Brown, the person who used the SAGE, said it was extended full out. Those inconsistencies don't change the outcome of the plaintiff's theory that the initiation of the attack caused Rudy Escobedo to be killed. As we pointed out in our cases, our succession of cases.
So your point is those details, the jury never got to see those or hear about those details.
Never got to hear those details. And in fact,
they knew ultimately that he was killed, but that was it.
They knew he was killed. But time and time again, in the closing argument, Mr. Keene kept using this gesture. Rudy Escobedo pointed the gun at the officers and they had no choice. There was no evidence to support that, purely speculation. Secondly, our expert, Mr. Danaher, said that there were two problems. One was the amount of tear gas. It clearly was more than debilitating. Rudy Escobedo had no choice but to retreat into his bedroom. Remember, one of the things that he ignored is that Rudy's communications were cut off. They couldn't talk to anybody. If they wanted to do anything over again, I'll bet that's what they would do. And then they would find that he still wanted to talk. Then they wouldn't have gone in. He called 5 times between the first assault of tear gas and 3 minutes before he was killed. And they knew that, but they wouldn't reveal that information. We had to get that long after we commenced our discovery. In conclusion, I would like to say that it is not a matter whether the jury verdict should be affirmed or not. They should not be allowed to have that jury verdict stand, that is, the defendants, because of the violations of Sherrod, and also because this court has an independent obligation to look at the circumstances denying summary judgment, which allowed them to initiate this tactical solution. Remember, nothing changed from the moment they arrived on the scene and the moment they changed their mind and started the assault. So in answer to your question, Judge Mannion, they reviewed the evidence. There was no change. The hospital was still there, 2 blocks away. The school was still there, 2 blocks away. They didn't remove all the residents on the floor. They didn't try to remove all the residents on the floor. Rudy had unbarricaded the door. Bender did not know all this information because they did not follow their procedure by having the phone system at a location where he could hear both the conversation from both sides and assess for himself with a proper
statement. And then remind me, what were the, there are so many facts in this case, what was the situation out on the street? Because one of the things counsel said was that Escobedo could have taken his gun and shot onto the street. Had the street been cleared and blocked off? I just can't remember.
It was, Your Honor, except
right
one
street. Outside the window, that had been done.
Right. There were several streets blocked off. A main artery on the one side of the building was not. They testified that traffic was moving fine and so forth. But more importantly...
But that was on the opposite side from where the window was. That's what I was trying to get clarity on.
That traffic was on the very far right, if you're looking from the perspective of Rudy Escobedo looking out his window, very far right, and may not even have been able to shoot at that direction because of the way the building was configured. But more importantly, there was... If he had done anything, they had snipers ready to respond immediately. The windows were never shot out, and as they testified, they never even saw him at the windows. So if anything, there was no indication that he posed a threat at any time, at any time. That's a pretty harsh consequence when you call somebody for help and they send a SWAT team and give you that little time to come out and seek treatment.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be